Welcome to the Traditional Arts Indiana podcast, featuring interviews with craftspeople and artists from our residency series at the Mathers Museum of World Cultures in Bloomington. I'm your host, Emily Burke. In today's podcast, Director of Traditional Arts Indiana, John Kay, speaks with bowl hewer Keith Rubel and weaver Dee Nierman. We hope you enjoy this interview, recorded in front of a live audience as part of Indiana University's Themester programming on the subject of beauty.
Welcome you all to the Mathers Museum of World Cultures. This is a program sponsored by the College of Arts and Sciences Themester program, which is celebrating beauty. And we've got a whole series of artists coming into the Mathers Museum this semester. And we're going to talk about folk art, and we're also going to talk about what makes folk art beautiful. What, when you look at a rag rug, what makes it pretty? When you look at a wooden bowl, what makes it pretty? And we'll have a couple of artists here with us. To my left, I actually have Dee Nierman, who's a fourth generation, at least, rag rug weaver. She works on a loom that her great-grandmother worked on. And to my right, we have Keith Rubel, who's a bowl hewer, and he's going to tell us about his craft. So let's just have a little conversation. We'll talk with Dee to start with here. Dee, can you tell us a little bit about where you're from, where you grew up, and how rug making kind of fits into that?
Okay, I'm from Jackson County, Indiana now, which is a Brownstown address. I was raised in Bartholomew County, which is north of Jackson County, lays next to it, and I've been weaving since probably 6 years old. My loom, I can trace back the one I use on now, 5 generations. To my great-grandmother, it's like 150 years old, so it's always been in my family. One on my dad's side of loom, one on my mom's. My niece weaves on the one on my dad's side, and I have on my mom's side. And it's just, I guess, comes naturally, because we didn't have a lot of things to do back then, no electricity. I remember when it came, so at night, that's what a lot of times we would do, cut rags. We would weave for people. They would bring their rags. So you would sit there and cut rags, and you got to sew them and then weave them. So it just is a thing that comes just naturally.
And we'll bring Keith in on this too. Keith, can you tell me where you're from and what your craft is and how you got introduced to it?
Well, I live south of Terre Haute now, but I was raised in a little town in southern Indiana called Aurora, Indiana, which is right along the Ohio River. Still have one leg longer than the other one from bringing dairy cows in the barn on hillsides. I was asked by Purdue University about 39 years ago to come to the Indiana State Fairgrounds to build an authentic log cabin from them. It's a shame they had to come to Indiana State to find a boy because no one at Purdue could do it. So I went up there and I hand-hewed a log cabin up there. And I was introduced to a man named Bill Day up there who made wooden bowls. And being a person who hand-hewed timbers with an axe, it was a natural for me. And Bill was a great man, told me where to get the tools. And I learned a little bit how he did it. And I started making bowls back just right after I got out of the fair and from there. And I've been making them for about 38 years now.
Can you go ahead and tell us a little bit about learning to build log buildings? Where did that come from?
That come from reading books. There was no one at the time, people to teach me. So I read several books from Sloan, Eric Sloan. I read Foxfire books and basically taught myself how to hew logs and ran into old men years ago and told me that I was doing it right. And since that time, I've been around probably 27 different cabins, been apart putting that many cabins up from scratch.
That's amazing. We'll go back over to Dee. Dee, can you just tell us a little bit about your earliest memories of rug making and why rug making was so important to your family? There was kind of a certain economic reason why it was important to your family.
Okay, my father and his brother were both killed when I was just 2 years old and 10 days. So, and my mother lived with my grandparents, her in-laws, and we always lived then together up until I was 21 years old. So mother had to, in the winter, she would bring the loom out of the old summer kitchen. We would put it in to this log house, like I've told many of you earlier. That's where we'd nail it down there, and that would pay for the taxes. You had to pay your taxes. We didn't have light bills, sewer bills, but we had to pay the taxes. And so that's really why we would bring it in there, so that, you know, we could, she could weave. She would weave for people. And I want to think back in those days, she might have only charged like 75 cents a yard to weave. We didn't write things down back then, but it was very, very cheap, you know, compared to nowadays. So it's just a matter of we had to do it, or she did. And then my grandma also wove. She was there. And then I would probably start at 6 or 7 to wind the shuttles like this. We wound the shuttles because my feet wouldn't reach the pedals by sitting on the seat. And so this is where we started out. Like I said to some of you, it's like when you learn to crawl and then to walk. So we started weaving shuttles and worked our way on up into weaving. And so that's really how we got started, I guess, out of necessity. The mother had to pay the bills.
Can you tell us a little bit about, you talk about weaving other people's scrap material and stuff. Where did your materials come from? Not all of your materials were from neighbors and stuff.
There was a woolen mill in Seymour, Indiana. He wove blankets for the war, in the Second World War. And mother would go there and get the pieces that they cut off of the blankets. And I can remember going as a child. Was little, because the boxes looked very big then, where you would look in, and we would take them home. And then the man, Mr. Love was his name, Jack Love, he had a store in the woolen mill where he would sell the rugs. My uncle also got killed, and his wife also wove. And my mother and my aunt were neighbors, one house between. So they would weave them for Mr. Love, and he would sell them. And also, there was like no waste. Mother said that he would weigh back any of the fuzz or whatever, what pieces you cut off, and you didn't get paid for none of that. He weighed that back through there. So you actually just got paid for what he got back. I mean, he would take off if there was any offfall or something.
That's amazing. That's pretty tight. Now, before we switch back over, tell us what happened when the woolen mill closed and what you had to do to keep making rugs.
Well, when the woolen mill closed, even before that, people would bring their rags already cut up for you. But then later in years now, that takes a long time to, say, cut your sleeve out of your shirt, or to cut your shirt and make all those little pieces and sew them together. So then I was at out east to muzzleloader shoot when I saw you could get this from Pendleton. I saw a blanket, had the Pendleton name, and that's how I got started with the woolen mill, or the woolen for the wool rugs. And it comes from Pendleton in Portland, Oregon. And so that's a lot easier. And if you want to, you won't make a living cutting rags or shirts and that up and sewing that together and weaving it, because it takes a great amount of time. Can you just stop and figure that? I mean, how long it would take and how many to your clothes. But these were our rag rugs. This would be our carpets in our home. We would finally get enough and make 3 strips, maybe 9 foot long. We would sew them together. And we would have newspapers under there in this log cabin that would keep the air from coming up through your carpet. That was our carpet. And then about once a year, we put it on the line and beat it. And if you know what a carpet beater is, that would be antique. You would beat it, hang it over the clothesline. And then the other, either fall or winter, what you chose, or fall or spring, I'm sorry, you would take them apart, those 3 strips, take the sewing all out of there, and you would wash them strips, then you would sew them all back together and start another cycle for another year. So we didn't have much free time. We kept busy, and my mother always said, the idle hands is the devil's workshop, so she kept us busy.
That's great. Keith, can you tell us a little bit about the creative process? You know, where do you get your wood? How do you prep your wood? What type of wood do you work with? That sort of thing.
Well, I'm a consultant forester on the side, and I spent 40 years as park superintendent in Vigo County. But since I retired, I'll be 70 years old in this month, and I still do work in the woods. Most of the work I do is physical. Some of you guys near, if I took you out today, I might run you in the ground because it's quite hard work. If you're not in shape, you can't handle it. But anyway, I'm in the woods all the time, and I've learned my trees as a young man in southern Indiana, and we manage right now. Right now, we got about 800 and some acres of forestry work to do this winter and next year, already contracted. So my wood that I use for the bowls comes easy. I usually go in and thin trees out, and the trees we thin out sometimes are the bowls, the woods I use to make bowls out of. And also, I have friends, arborists, that take trees out of people's yards, and I get all the wood that I need to make bowls. And sometimes I have so much wood I don't have time to do it all. Because as I've told most of you, it takes time to make things. A bowl like this will take at least 4 hours to make. And this is a shape I make. Most of the bowls I make are in shape of Indiana. But I do look for unusual woods in the forest products like Kentucky coffee bean, white walnut or butternut, cherry and walnut. It's very common in Indiana. That's cherry is my favorite wood to work, because it's so beautiful when it's finished, and it gets more beautiful with the ages. But woods are pretty much easy for me to find. Anymore, I spend a lot of time in the woods, and so it's pretty common, pretty easy to find it. And the people who come and I've taught, I usually find wood for them. But every county, every city has got someone who does tree trimming, and usually they have a waste area, and usually you can find all the wood you want to learn how to do this, just making bowls.
There are certain types of woods that you use. You mentioned a few. How about when you look at the tree? Can you decide whether this tree is going to make a good bowl and that one's not, or pretty much if it's one of those, that species of tree, you can get a bowl out of it?
It used to be that I tried to get trees that had few knots in them. But a bowl with a knot in it will sell quicker than a bowl that's clear, because a knot will give character to that bowl. And sometimes it's hard to get that bowl cued out to where that knot will stay put in the bowl. But if I can get it done, it'll sell quicker than a bowl that doesn't have a knot in it. But yeah, I can look at a tree and tell by looking at it somewhat the characteristic of it. For different things outside of bowls, even wooden buckets and things I make. Grain patterns are really unique. Sometimes the wood itself may come below the ground surface, like walnut. Walnut burl would be down below the wood, the bottom of the tree. And some people who make gun stocks know that that's where the most beautiful grain patterns are at, down below the ground. And but I try to get wood like that. And sometimes I'll cut them out with a saw in such a way that the wood grain is quite unique. If you walk out this hallway and go down where that desk is at, if you look at the woodwork on that desk, that's all quarter sawn white oak. And if you know how to cut out a log to where you can get it quarter sawed, sycamore is another one. If you can know how to do that, you can make your bowls much more beautiful by learning how to cut it out to get that unique grain pattern. That just comes with experience. But most woods, most trees I see, I make bowls out of, they're already on the ground normally, and I can roll them over and pretty much tell what I want. But a typical bowl, a tree that's 16 inches in diameter, that may be cut into a block, the sawmill may get maybe $75 to $150 for that log if it's sold to someplace else. If that same log is put into bowls, I may get close to $1,000 out of that one log, just by making bowls out of it.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, I have some more questions for you, but let's talk with Dee. Dee, I'm going to hold up one or two of your rugs here for us to talk about here. I want you to tell us a little bit about what you think makes a pretty rug and what your customers think makes a pretty rug. And I imagine there are things they're looking for that you could care less about, and there are things that you care about what makes a good rug that they may not even notice.
Like I say, now we're into the wool because it is faster, and we do a few shows a year. This one, you'll see all different colors in there. Someone may want to come and pick out, say, the light green, and they only want a 4-foot rug, and I have enough material to make a 5-foot. Well, then you have some left over, so the one like John's holding up is made out of different pieces that were left over. And this one, I've kind of made a center in it, the light green. I went one end up to the light green, and then I went backwards on the other end. Some will just make it completely whatever, might be 15 colors. And it's a preference. I guess I prefer this. You have a middle, and then you go reverse, go the other way. But, and I know sometime I weave, and I think, oh, my. And my niece laughs because I don't want to weave two the same color, one right after another. I used to do a little knitting, and I said I just would knit for somebody with one hand or one foot because I never like to do the second one right away. I don't know what that is. But if I do a striped one, I probably wouldn't do that right away again. Or if I do like the orange ones, I would want to go to green or something. I don't know what that is. I mean, I don't know what it is, but I just like to change. I like something different. So therefore, what some people really like, some really want the bright colors. Well, that doesn't fit in my house. Of course, mine is just like whatever you pick up. John knows how my house is. But, you know, if it fits in your decor, your color, I'm happy to make it for them. Have people send me colors or tell me what colors they want or send me pieces of material, and then I will send them samples. I'm glad to do that. And if I make the rugs, I can send it to them. I've done it. And they'll pay the shipping. So the one does not fit everybody's whatever they desire, you know. So we just kind of one way and then another, whichever you like. Right. And I kind of like the dollar ones. The green is my favorite color, so I kind of like green. But green is hard to get from Pendleton, where the wool comes from. I don't know why. Off-white, they hardly ever weave off-white for their blankets or anything. And those are really good sellers for people that buy for gifts, don't know someone's color in their home, their color scheme, they would take that. But for 5 or 6, 7 years, I have not got the off-white. So it's just kind of your preference.
Right. When you've seen other weavers' rugs and that type of thing, what makes a good rug? What are you when you see your rugs versus somebody else's rugs? What does your weaver's eyes tell you about that?
When I see different rugs, one thing is the older loom, like I have it's called a barn loom or something. It's taller than I am when I stand up. You have a lot of weight on your beater bar to beat that warp in there. I beat almost every time I put a shot through there, which is one piece of the warp through there. I beat that 3 times, and I change my pedals. That really beats it in there. And the heavier that beater bar is, and mine is made out of, I don't know what kind of wood it is, the gentleman over there might, but it's heavy. So it really beats it in there tight. And you want to keep your strings or your warp, you want to keep those tight, your tension on your loom. And then you can really pack it in there, because I have watched them judge rugs already. And they try to stick their finger between there where you put the shots through there, to stick their finger through there. And mine is, you can do it, but you have to work at it a little bit. So if you, and I use 2 strings together, and that way if one does break on your warp, then you still have 1 string to hold it. So I look for that also. And I like frayless cotton, but they don't make it anymore, so now I have to go to poly cotton. But, and it should hold good, but, and when you shake your rugs, shake them from the, hold them on the sides, not on like John has, because when you turn them on the end, you whip them fringes, or those, yeah, the fringe out. I mean, not right away, but the fringe is usually the first thing that goes on a rug. But if you'll shake them from the side, that would give them a little more life. And they wear well. These wool rugs are washable, and they wear well. And you, and one thing, if you have a dirty side and company comes, just turn it over. You got another side, and it's not rubber backing or nothing. And I have nothing against that, but you have one clean side.
Who do you make your rugs for? Where do you sell these other than just out of your house?
We usually do, my niece and I, about two or three shows a year. We'll do Fort Bologna. That's, I believe it's always the second weekend in October. We do Milan in November. And this year we're going to try to do, I think, Montgomery if we get in down there at down in, I think, it's Davis County. And people just call or... I don't know, they just, word of mouth. I don't advertise, I don't have a store, but people that know it, it's just by word of mouth. I've got them in India, Africa, Japan, people that have been here through the years, because I've been doing this. I'm just turned 80 years old, so I've been doing it for many years, and it's just kind of word of mouth. I know you all have computers and things like that, which I don't have, and that's great. That's another generation, but... it's just kind of word of mouth is the way it goes. And we don't have like where we're in a building or anywhere you can buy them. So if you want a card, I have some out there at the desk or at the table.
You mentioned the Japanese ladies that you you sold the rugs to. Do they come visit you anymore?
Evidently, I live around Seymour, Indiana, and I haven't seen any. There must be some there, but they would have people where they were learning the English language, and they would bring them. Sometime I would have six or seven, but I haven't seen them for maybe 4 or 5 years, so I don't know if... my understanding was they would spend so many years here, and then they would go back. But I don't even see them around Seymour. So I don't really know, but they haven't been to my house, but they really loved them, and they had an interpreter, some of them, you know. And that was great. I always... Well, any nationality or what, you know, it's just happy to, I'm happy to work with them, so.
That's great. Let's talk to you, Keith, about, you talked about the type of bowl you make a lot of. Can you said you learned from Bill Day. Can you tell us a little bit about how your bowls are different than Bill Day's?
My bowls are thinner than his. He made them a lot thicker. And to me, the more delicate, the thinner the wood is on a bowl, and the better it feels in your hand is what I like. And most people today who make bowls make them thick because they're a little afraid of going on farther to make them thin. And when you make them thin, they become more fragile, and they're easy to crack. So that is the expertise that I try to put into my woodwork, to make them unique, so that when someone picks them up, you know, this is light. You know, they like that. So, but of course, I work with green wood, and when you use a tool like this called an adze, you have to be extra careful because you're constantly hewing or pounding on that wood, and you have to know how to hold it in such a way that the impact of that adze hitting that wood is absorbed by the block of wood below it instead of absorbed by the bowl itself. So I'm basically shearing it off the wood little by little to get it into a finished product. And when I get into the finished product, then it's just a matter of going in and knowing where to stop and then put a finish on it. And I always try to find something that's got unique grain to it. And usually if I find something unique grain, my first wife in the back, she likes to capture that and not put it on the selling block. But a lot of times I end up giving something away that's unique instead of trying to sell it.
Where do you sell most of your bowls?
Most of the bowls that I make are sold at the Indiana State Fair at the Purdue Ag Alumni Pioneer Building. I'm not a Purdue Ag, but I sell a lot of them there. I sell a lot of them out of my house. I'm asked to go a lot of different places in Indiana to demonstrate this, but I just don't have time to do it, and I can't make enough to do that, to go to all these places. But I make, I don't know how many bulls I make a year, but I took 135 to Indiana State Fairgrounds this year. I think I brought back about 25. So that's a year of making these bulls, and most of them were Indiana bulls. I make five different sizes of Indiana bulls, and they're the most popular. And since it's the bicentennial year, I designed the logo on the back of it to put the bicentennial logo on the boat logo on the back of it. But the woods that I use, it's getting kind of scary out there. Being a forester, where our trees in the Midwest are in trouble right now because of a lot of things going on. Since we are a world economy, as you know, here in Bloomington, and I've drove through Bloomington this morning, ash trees are all dying because the emerald ash borer coming in from Asia. And then there's another one called the Asian longhorn beetle that if it gets into the forest land, it's gonna wipe out the maple industry. Walnut has got a canker that may be coming in that could destroy the walnuts. Red oak blight is another one that we're worried about, but it's kind of scary what's going on. And some of my forester friends said it's going to be probably in 50 years we're going to be down to a few species of trees because of what's going on in the atmosphere and stuff coming over from different countries. It's absolutely scary. And I can see it right now. The year 2012, we had the severe blight. It's still showing effects on trees here in Indiana. So, and the Hoosier National Forest is showing that too. So it's quite scary, but I'm being 70 years old, I haven't got too many more years to do this, so hope that my son and other people that I'm trying to teach will carry us on. We'll still have a lot of different species of wood to work with.
Can you tell us a little bit about the next generation, who you're passing this on to?
Okay. I've had a number of people ask me to learn this. A guy I taught up in Vigo County, he started teaching class. He charged $400-some for three sessions. I don't want to do that. I do it for free. People come to my house or we'll go someplace, and I spend a day with them to teach them how to do it. I'm teaching my son, and I've taught some women. I've taught men how to do it, and I'd like to carry it on because, you know, all you students out here, it's very, very important for you to learn something that you could do the rest of your life other than work. You need to learn a lifetime activities. It's so important to take up something, and you maybe watch or learn something you heard this morning that you might want to learn that you can do the rest of your life because you've been taught sports. You know, sports has been ingrained in us when we're young. But you know, when you get to be 30 years old, you can't run up and down the basketball court or the football field. But you know, I can do this the rest of my life, or do blacksmithing, or do gardening, or do something that you can do the rest of your life. And this lifetime activity thing is so important, and it'd be nice if that would introduce to elementary schools to teach kids little things at a small age that they can pick it up. But we're so academic oriented now that those things like art and things, you know, and music, they're trying to put them on the back shelf in schools, and our children aren't taught that a lot like they should be taught. So I'm hoping that what I do in my life, the rest of my life, I can teach some people that can carry what I do on so that other people in the future can come and look at something unique and beautiful that you can get out of a raw piece of wood and turn into something beautiful.
I'm going to ask Dee one more question, then I'll open it up to the audience to see if you all have questions to ask ask her. But Dee, I wanted to ask you about the future of your craft here. You talked a lot about the history of it and in your life. Where is it going to in the future?
Well, I have no children, and my niece that weaves, she's never been married and isn't married. So we have to go down to cousins. My third cousin, hopefully she and her sister will learn from my niece. She lives close to them. She asked the mother whether the girls would be interested. There's just two girls close. And she said she thought they might. They were still in grade school, so we're hoping that it will be passed on to them. And like I say, I wove, and I'm 80 years old. And like he said, you don't keep going. And for this big loom, it takes a lot of strength to do it. But you can get smaller looms like the one I have out there, or even that little wooden one where you just weave the shuttle in and out, you can still do something on them. But it takes a lot of strength on that big loom to tighten that and keep that tension tight so you have a good tight rug. But hopefully, about my third cousins will do that. And that's our only hope. So, but like he said, you know, in school, it seems like now they've even taken out the writing. You print or use a computer. Well, I remember when we printed things in grade school, that was like a no-no. You had to learn how to write. First you printed, but we didn't have kindergarten or preschool or nursery school. We just jumped right in the first grade, and I went to one-room school all 8 years. And you know there's an advantage, because if you get to the second grade and you miss something in the first, you can go, you can listen. They're all in that same room. We had one teacher, taught all 8 grades, and we all graduated as far as I know. And I didn't go to college, couldn't afford it, and there wasn't credit cards, so I didn't go to college. But there's so much in your future, and there's so much you can even pick up on the computer. I'm aware of it, but I don't know how to do it. And it's wonderful. I think there's bad in everything, but there can be good made out of that. And take advantage of it while you're young. Listen, learn from us old folks, so to speak. And we have a lot of knowledge that's already been passed on through generations, and you'll be able to pass it on to the next generations to come and when we'll be no longer here. So good luck to all of you. Thank you.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, I felt like there should be a resounding applause there or something. But are there any questions before we thank our guests for being here? Someone's got to have some questions there. Yes.
In some of the previous artists that came, they mentioned that they had communities that they were involved in from around the Midwest that did, you know, the same type of work. Are either of you involved in clubs, communities, people that craft the same way you do, enjoy doing that, things like that?
Let me repeat the question here so it'll be on the recording. The question was, some of the artists that we've had have talked about affinity groups that are actually associated with like blacksmithing or basket weaving and that sort of thing that the folks are engaged with. Are either of you involved with that, with a special interest group or even just a group of friends that do the similar craft?
Group of friends. Of course, the most of the people that make bowls in my part of the state and different places, I taught them and they've taught other people. But we do talk amongst one another and share ideas and things like that so that we can help improve the other people's work somewhat. And I know in some of the circles that I work with in blacksmith, they have like John Bennett, there's groups, and over my way, there's a blacksmith group, Indiana Blacksmith Association. They get together and teach. And like I was telling you this morning, that every third weekend they have a blacksmith meeting, and they encourage young people to come up and they teach the basics of blacksmithing. So they want to keep it alive. So, and I do too, and I'm sure you do too on rug making. So anybody that does this for a number of years, they would surely like to pass it on, at least I do. So, yeah, it's important to keep with people like that.
How about you, Dee? Do you have any special groups you've been a part of?
I have years ago been a part of the Spinners and Weavers group. And in 1998, I went to a big convergence at Portland, Oregon, which was very interesting. And but right now, at my age, several of them have already passed on. I have, through the years, gone to Bloomington and took some on warping different looms and on spinning. And I think, like I told some of you, I think Yarns Unlimited is still here. They were very helpful when many years, maybe 20 years ago, when I came out here with the group. But as of right now, no. I mean, there's a few of us weavers that talk to each other, but not. I don't really belong to any now because well, I did many years ago.
You told me one time about doing a sheep to shawl and what your leg of that competition was. Can you tell people what a sheep to shawl is and what you did?
We went sheep to shawl a few years at the Indiana State Fair. There was a group of us, like five, We had one weaver designated, and we had a certain length, and a certain length to the shawl we made, and to the length of time. Of course, we had to card it, we had to spin it, we had to ply it, and we had to weave it in a certain length of time. That was the Indiana State Fair. Then we went to Kentucky. Since we raised llamas, we done a llama to luxury, which was the same thing, the same group of people, and it was really fun. I mean, it was a challenge, but there again, a lot of them, they moved, or we just dropped out of it. But we've done it several years, and it's fun. So if you get interested in any kind of a handmade things, get in a group, and you can really get each other stirred up to see what else you can learn. It's very interesting, and I've really enjoyed it through my earlier years, and I still enjoy weaving. Hopefully many more years. I don't know how many, but I hope to do it a few more years.
That's great. I think we've got time for maybe one more question. Anybody got a question? Over here, and then we'll let Keith ask the last one. Right. I'm going to modify your question. The question was, what's the price that you sell a rug for? I'm going to add, what's the average time plus what's the average price that you end up selling them for a rug?
Well, it takes, if I already got the material, it's already like the selvages I get from Pendleton for about a yard long, which is, everybody should know, is 36 inches. That takes me about 45 minutes to an hour. It just depends on, and like it's anything, if you have a little trouble, strings break, but just to weave. And the price, I want to think it's like $37 a yard. Tax, you know, is added into. We just changed that recently, and I've just got it. I didn't bring it with me. It's all printed out. But that's an average of what it is. But it takes about an hour. The loom is already dressed, has the warp on there, which I said takes roughly 4 hours from the warping board to the loom. So it takes roughly an hour to do that. So.
How about you, Keith?
Most of what I make is $30 up. I've sold bowls up to $400 bowls, big ones. But everything most of what I make is under $50. The wood for me is free. I get it free. A bowl like this will sell for $40. You know, they make it about 3 hours or so. I'll make it a little over $10 an hour, which is not very much. So a wet minimum wage. But I don't do it to make money. I do it for enjoyment. This is a stress reliever for me. You know, that's basically what I charge.
That's great. You had a question.
Yeah. How many, as I mentioned earlier when I was talking about lifetime activities, how many of you students, and raise your hands, have an activity right now that you can do the rest of your life that you enjoy doing? Raise your hand. Not very many. A few of you. That's good. That's really good. So it's important to the ones who haven't got an activity yet, think about that, you know. And I always, you know, those smartphones you got, if I had one of them, I would probably take it down to the Wabash River and see how far I could skip it. Because I know that those things, my oldest son, Luke, he's a forester and an arborist. And I had told him, because every time I see him, and I'm sure if I watched you, I was watching a young lady right now with hers, but you got your nose buried in them all day long. I said, you know, I've walked by people on the street, and I said, hey, don't run into a pole down there when you walk by me. But I asked my son, Luke, I said, why is it that every time I see you, got your head buried in there? He said, Dad, he says, you know that I could find anything I want to know about anything on this thing right here. But I said, you know, you can't raise your children looking at that thing. Throw that sucker away when you got children. You know, you got to be able to spend time with your children, you know. But today, you know, kids are not learning about the outdoors, you know. They're staying inside, because one of my college professors told me several years ago, he said, you know, he said, Keith, you learned something about the outdoors that my students, they don't get. Now, he's a science teacher. He's a well-known ecologist here in Indiana State, Indiana. He wrote Natural Heritage of Indiana. And he said, you got something that my students, they didn't get. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, you learned about the outdoors by going out and catching snakes and fishing and all that stuff. My kids today, they're good students. They know their subject, but didn't get what you got. He said, you know why? And I thought a minute and thought a minute. And I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. He said, air conditioning. Kids today don't go outside. They stay inside. And you can put that computer, that handheld computer in your hand to do the same thing. So teach your kids things about outdoors, you know, because that's really important.
Well, I know we've come to the end of our time, probably a little bit over our time. Thank you all for being here. Let's thank Keith and Dee for their time.
Thank you for joining us. We hope you have enjoyed this podcast and will tune in again next time. This podcast would not be possible without the support of the National Endowment for the Arts, the Indiana Arts Commission, and Indiana University's Themester Program.